It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It was a hold-your-breath moment on Wall Street yesterday when trading was abruptly halted because of a computer glitch. Trading, I'm already nervous just thinking about it. A computer glitch. Trading on the floor of the stock exchange remained shut down for more than 3.5 hours. The White House believes there was no malice behind what happened. Still, the incident brings to the forefront how vulnerable the markets have become due to technical failures. Joining me now by phone to discuss what can be learned from yesterday's event is Jay Sukits. He's Clinical Assistant Professor of Business Administration and Finance at the University of Pittsburgh. Jay Sukits, good to have you with us.
Hey, hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. If you have a comment or question about what happened on Wall Street yesterday, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. Again, that's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. And we would imagine that there are a number of concerned investors out there wondering what all this means, whether it could happen again, how bad it could possibly become somewhere down the road. Jay Sukits, has this incident illustrated how dependent the markets are on technology and how vulnerable they are when it fails?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent, Paul, you know, the technology aspect of this has not only caused problems like the software glitch that occurred yesterday, which basically effectively caused the computers at the floor of the New York Stock Exchange to stop recognizing certain stock ticker symbols. And because all trades are put in, whether it's electronically or years ago on paper, they're all put in by symbol, not by the name of the company. That caused trading in any number. I think the estimate was about 400 different issues to not be recognized, number one. And, of course, number two, the managers of the New York Stock Exchange saw that, and they shut down all trading. They canceled all the open orders that existed, so the orders that had come in, and they stopped trading in order to fix the glitch. So that's the downside. The upside of the technology is that today only about 18% of the entire volume of all of the stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange are actually traded on the floor of the exchange. Over 80% of the trades effectively go to things like dark pools, as they're called, things like electronic communications networks. ECNs are essentially electronic broker-dealers, and they match up trades. Dark pools are computer servers, and they're run by a number of the big investment banks and some other trading firms. So although it appeared at first glance that this was a major problem, trading overall did not really get interrupted.
Now, you mentioned that the electronic markets that have opened in recent years, for example, the New York Stock Exchange, as you said, is now responsible for, I believe it, your figure was 18% of trading activity.
Well, it's not. The stock exchange itself, if you look at all the trading activity, NASDAQ, there's a few small regional exchanges, the total volume that's actually on the floor, it's not really on the exchange, but on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, that's actually what's taking place, you know, in that building.
I see. Okay.
That's only about 12.5% of the total volume of all stocks.
And the rest of it is done.
And if you just limit it to the stocks that are listed on the New York Stock Exchange, the actual trading that takes place on the floor is only about 18% of the stocks that are listed. And it all depends how trades are routed. Like if you put in a trade with TD Ameritrade, let's say, they can route your trade through an electronic communications network, through an electronic broker, or some trades may go through a dark pool. Others might go to the floor of the exchange. It depends on where the most efficient executions are occurring at any point in time.
All right, so before we get back to looking at the impact of this just in terms of the security of the market and the vulnerability of the market is the proliferation of new. Yes, can you hear me?
They lost.
Jay, you're on the air with us. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Jay. Can you hear us?
Yeah, did I lose you?
No, we're here. You're still here. So I'm going to continue firing questions at you.
No, I'm in a car right now. We're traveling and we went under a bridge. I lost you.
Okay, well, you know, that used to happen all the time on radio, but you've got me and I've got you. So here's my question. Is the proliferation of new trading venues a good thing for investors?
Personally, I think it is because it creates more liquidity and it creates more competition between the trading venues. Consequently, what's happened is, and I think you see this if you explore a little bit, the actual execution costs, the amount the investor pays to actually execute a trade has become de minimis. In some cases, if you have enough assets in your account, you can trade for free. So I think it's a good thing. There are criticisms of the system, but what's very interesting is most of the criticism tends to come from other electronic brokerage networks, and I think it comes from them because they don't want the competition.
Are we more likely to see the type of thing that happened yesterday in this brave new technological world just because of all the different ways that people can trade now?
Well, you know, the way in which, I mean, it's not necessarily up to the individual to decide, quote, how they're going to trade. It really depends on the intermediary that they're dealing with. And, you know, it may very well be at some point in time. You could see this at some point in time, especially given the fact that, you know, the New York Stock Exchange is owned by ISE, you know, an international corporation. I think you could see at some point in time where investors will be able to effectively trade at any time of the day, trade any securities 24 hours a day.
But in terms of what this means for the market, you know, we saw a 3.5-hour shutdown yesterday. Is there the potential for the market being shut down for longer periods of time on the New York Stock Exchange? And is someone out there, some, you know, insidious entity of some kind, looking at what happened and thinking there may be a way that we can infiltrate the system and shut it down, not just for a day or two, but maybe even for weeks? Jay? Apparently I stumped him with that question. Jay Sukits, we'll try to get him back on the cell phone, which is not behaving as well as we had hoped, but we have a couple more questions for him. We have a caller on the line that we want to work into the conversation as well. So while we're getting Jay Sukits back on the line with us, I will let you know that coming up later in the program, we're going to talk about the budget impasse at the state legislature, the ideas being floated by both the governor and the legislature, where the middle ground might be, and which of these proposals makes the most sense economically. We'll be talking with Steve Herzenberg of the Keystone Research Center and Liz Stell of the Commonwealth Foundation. That's coming up a little bit later in the program. And this also gives me the opportunity to mention that WESA is holding a community forum on the impact of the Americans with Disabilities Act on our city next Wednesday, July 15th. The ADA turns 25 this year, and the question is, how far have we come? What remains to be done? Later in the show, we'll tell you how you can register to be a part of that forum on the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Right now, we've got Jay Sukits back on the line. Jay, you must have gone under another bridge. Good to have you back.
Yeah, I went under something. I'm not sure what.
Well, did you get the gist of my question, which was, you know, based on what happened yesterday, what kind of ideas can an insidious entity glean from what happened? And could there be the possibility that a the White House is saying there was no malice behind this. But what if there is in the future? Could the market in some way, because of how it's structured now, technologically be shut down for a longer period of time?
Well, there are so many different, effectively, electronic venues to trade in now that just as an example, that glitch that occurred yesterday really didn't affect trading at all. I heard a number of institutional investors interviewed about it over the course of the last day or so, and they said that it didn't affect them at all. My guess is if you're an individual investor and you put a trade in with your broker, your trade got executed as well. I think that probably the bigger problem, besides the notion of not being able to trade, might be an attack on, let's say, this could be a cyber attack or some other kind of an attack on an electricity grid or on the electric grid itself. There you run into a situation where perhaps all of these electronic venues for exchanges could be shut down. I doubt if any one particular cyber attack could eliminate all of the different trading venues, though.
Let's take a call from Ted from Mount Washington. Ted, you're on with Jay Sukits.
How you guys doing? Real quick, my question is simple. What role does the Fed and the Treasury play when there's a crisis at Wall Street? And also, why we're not spending more money on infrastructure? It seems like a power grid, is the most pressing thing that we need in this country as far as building our infrastructure.
Okay, Jay, what about Ted's concerns?
Well, I could agree. I agree with him on the infrastructure question, but, the bottom line is the New York Stock Exchange, other exchanges are private companies. So I don't think you're going to have Congress spending necessarily taxpayer money for infrastructure on private companies. I think those companies, they want to continue to do business. They want to remain very competitive. So I think, they stay cutting edge in terms of the defensive measures that they take against cyber problems or against these kind of glitches. In terms of regulatory overview on this that comes from the Treasury or the SEC or the Fed, there's really no difference. I mean, the Fed has their oversight capabilities on the markets through both their classification of what kind of investors there are, i.e. unsophisticated or sophisticated investors, and then the Fed also has an oversight on how much you can borrow on margin against securities. The Treasury has some oversight, but the SEC and the NASD, the National Association of Security Dealers, they're much closer to the oversight of what goes on in terms of trading. And I'm not sure any regulatory changes would make any difference to what happened yesterday. I think almost everyone agrees that what happened yesterday was a software problem.
And are you satisfied with the explanation that it was just a technical glitch and there was no malice behind it?
Yeah, I am, because I don't think it was very widespread. I mean, if we would have seen something like, the entire NASD broker-dealer system, which are, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dealers all tied together in a computer network, if we would have seen that entire system shut down and nobody could trade through that system on any exchange, I would have said, hey, that's a little more suspicious. But the fact is, the New York Stock Exchange does software upgrades all the time. And I think, anybody who works with any kind of either mobile device, computer, et cetera, knows that when you get a software upgrade in your device or on your computer, there's a chance that you can have a glitch, a temporary glitch.
Jay Sukits is a clinical assistant professor of business administration and finance at the University of Pittsburgh. Jay, thanks for taking the time to join us. We appreciate it. Coming up, weighing the proposals coming from the two sides involved in the state budget impasse. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. More than a week after the budget deadline passed for Pennsylvania legislators, it's become clear that very little progress has been made in negotiations to find common ground between what Governor Wolf wants and what the Republican-controlled legislature has put on the table. The governor wants to see increases to the personal income and sales tax to help fund his property tax plan for schools and homeowners. However, legislators on the right believe that money would be better kept in the pockets of Pennsylvanians. The governor also wants a tax on drilling, which the legislature is reluctant to agree to. Meanwhile, Governor Wolf has vetoed or is about to veto a Republican bill to privatize liquor sales as well as a pension reform bill. So, who's right, who's wrong, or does what makes sense lie somewhere in between? Here to talk about and make some economic sense of these ideas, as well as President Obama's proposal to make more salaried employees eligible for overtime, is Keystone Research Center Executive Director Steve Herzenberg. He joins us by phone. Steve Herzenberg, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here again.
And also with us in studio is Commonwealth Foundation Director of Policy Analysis, Liz Stell. Liz Stell, good to have you with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Steve Herzenberg, we'll begin with you. Looking at what's on the table in the Republican legislature's proposed budget and knowing what Governor Wolf wants and why he vetoed it, what makes sense to you and what doesn't?
Well, the Republican budget certainly doesn't make sense to us. It's a budget that stays a course that's not working. In Pennsylvania, for 4 years now, has had budgets that were based on the misguided idea that you can cut your way to prosperity. Deep cuts in education funding in 2011 that slowed down our recovery. The track record on that approach is very clear, 48th in job growth, 43rd in revenue growth, 40th in terms of the decline in the underemployment rate. So that's not working, but this budget, unfortunately, is more of the same. The second thing that's disappointing is it's a very one-sided budget. I mean, we know that we have divided government, so therefore we're going to have to end up somewhere in the middle. But the Republican majority in the legislature had 4 months to scrutinize Governor Wolf's budget. If they wanted to offer something as a starting point in the beginning of May, then they could go back and forth and end up in the middle. But to come forward at the very last second with a budget that's completely their priorities gave Governor Wolf no choice but to simply veto the whole thing. So it's disappointing. It's a little bit of a political theater kabuki play. Hopefully we could get through this now and then get back to negotiating a budget that doesn't stay a course that's not working, that is more fiscally sound than the Republican budget put forward, and that incorporates Governor Wolf's priorities, which frankly are much more aligned with Pennsylvania voters, at least when it comes to education funding and when it comes to the need for a common sense severance tax.
Liz Stell, same question, and you heard what Steve had to say about the kabuki theater. That's the first time I think I've heard that used to describe this budget, or at least the way that it was presented. I'm sure you're going to take issue with some of what Steve said, but does he have a point when he says that the legislature had to know when they basically approved a budget that had all of the GOP priorities in it and very little, if anything, of what the governor wanted, and threw it at him at the last minute and said, okay, here it is, governor. I mean, should we be surprised that the governor ended up saying, no way I'm going to sign this?
Well, I think it's important to first point out that the budget that the Republicans proposed and pushed through the legislature is really very much continues the trend of more state spending, of staying the course of spending year after year after year. So the thought that we're doing something or we've done something different the last 4 years, it is not really true. We've seen state budget growth 44 out of the last 45 budgets. So we're continuing to spend more. Nothing is different there. The Republicans want to spend more. The governor wants to spend more. So that's the same. In terms of...
Is that a good thing in your view?
You know, we think that that is an issue and that there shouldn't always be an assumption that every year we have to spend more. We should always be looking to see if there are other ways that we can better spend the funds that we're already asking from Pennsylvania families. In terms of, was it fair to give a budget to the governor with such a short window? You know, that's part of the drama of Harrisburg, and I'm not going to defend what the Republicans do or don't do. But I think it's notable that the governor has vetoed the entire budget, not just line item, as others have in the past. And that's actually a pretty unusual thing. And not only did he veto the entire budget, but he vetoed liquor privatization, which is very popular amongst voters. And it looks like he's now going to veto pension reform, which is really a historic achievement and something that really gets to a problem I'm sure we'll hit on later with the discussion over property taxes. So I think that the governor could have been a little more reasonable in looking at parts of the budget where there is some agreement.
Which parts, if you're saying that what he should have done was do a line item as instead of a across the board veto of the entire budget, what would be the things that you mentioned liquor privatization, which depending on who you talk to is more or less of a priority for Pennsylvanians than some of the other issues. But what are some of the things that you would cite as examples of what the governor could have left in?
Right. Well, one thing that I think there is some agreement on in Harrisburg is the idea that we need a better way to distribute our education funding. And the new education funding formula was part of this budget. That got vetoed with the larger bill. So I think it's I don't think it was wise for the governor to go ahead and do a wide sweeping veto of the entire package when I think there are some places that Republicans and the governor can agree upon.
All right. And we'll look at some compromises or where you and Steve Herzenberg think compromises can be made, where the middle ground might be. Again, we're talking about the pros and cons of the budget situation. What ideas do we like? What ideas do we don't like? We're not going to agree on everything, but I think that's part of the beauty of this is that we can identify things that we think work and then figure out what the compromises can possibly be. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. Again, like to get some folks in the mix. I'm sure that you are maybe tired of hearing about the budget impasse, but it affects all of us, and we all have our concerns. We all have our priorities. What are yours? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Let's talk about the liquor privatization. It's something that Steve Herzenberg, this is something that a lot of Pennsylvanians seem to want, if not privatization, some sort of different way, a more convenient way of being able to purchase liquor in the state of Pennsylvania, which is the only one that has the if I may use the word, archaic system that we have. Whether you like it or not, it's something that goes back to prohibition, and it bothers a lot of people. Why should, assuming you support the governor's veto of liquor privatization, why should we keep things the way they are?
So first, I want to just correct one thing in terms of the growth of the state budget over time. If you look at the at state taxes as a share of the overall economy in Pennsylvania, that's basically unchanged as far back as the data I've ever seen, going back to 1977. It's basically 6% of the state economy. So we have inflation, which tends to mean that the dollars go up, but in terms of inflation-adjusted dollars and also in terms of the share of the economy, state spending and taxation haven't grown. In terms of wine and spirits, it is something that has tended to be relatively popular, although if you look at the polls over the last few years, it seems to get less popular with each passing year in which the Republicans and previously Governor Corbett play with the idea, because I think voters began to get onto the fact that this is sort of this is politicking, and this isn't really about the consumer and choice. From our point of view, there are two reasons that you might not, as a public policy issue, to privatize. They're pretty simple ones. One is the best research shows that states make more revenue from the wine and spirits industry where there's a large amount of state control. And so the state's wholesale monopoly, for example, that is the critical thing to maximizing state revenue from this industry. So at a time when the Republicans have put together a budget that would have a $3 billion hole by the end of next fiscal year, you can't be talking about giving up a state asset that, from a long-term perspective, is good for state revenues. And the second thing is the social impacts. I mean, wine and spirits are different than most industries. When people abuse wine and spirits, you have car accidents and people have health problems. And the national public health consensus, a task force staffed by the Center for Disease Control, concluded a number of years ago that that states shouldn't further privatize the distribution of wine and spirits. So from our point of view, on common sense, non-ideological grounds, that is the state's need for revenue and the fact that we don't want more traffic fatalities and health problems associated with liquor abuse, we ought to modernize the current system, perhaps improve consumer choice, absolutely, but we shouldn't privatize.
When it comes to privatization, there may be Liz Stell of the Commonwealth Foundation. There may be reasons, legitimate reasons, for wanting to, as the Republicans like to say, get out of the business, get the state government out of the business of selling liquor. But from an economic standpoint, you have someone like Steve who's saying, and the governor said it on this very show just last Thursday, a week ago today, he said that this is an asset that we cannot afford to lose given our current financial circumstances. What is your view on it?
Right. Well, most of the revenue from the liquor system comes from taxes placed on liquor that not change under privatization. So saying that liquor is an asset and that if we privatize it, all the revenue will go away is like saying the IRS is the most profitable part of the federal government. Those taxes are not going to change. So I think it's disingenuous to say that we're going to take a hit by privatizing. If anything, we actually might see more revenue because there'll be a chance for more stores, for more competition in this sector. And when you talk about, you know, safety and the importance of making sure that we're protecting Pennsylvanians, if you look at a lot of the specific statistics, Pennsylvania doesn't do any better. We're kind of middle of the pack in a lot of those areas, things like binge drinking, underage drinking. So we're really not any safer underneath this government monopoly. So I don't think you can make a credible argument that way.
It's kind of like prohibition, isn't it? I mean, people still manage to get alcohol. And in fact, when people had to endeavor and create ways to distribute it, you got organized crime involved.
Right.
Obviously, not the same thing here. But the point is, if people want something, they're going to get it, regardless of what the laws are.
Well, and you can still have the control aspect. You know, the PCLB, the Pennsylvania Controlled Liquor Board, can still be in charge of making sure that we're, you know, policing this substance, that we're doing education, all of those roles can still be maintained with a privatized system. Right now, they have very much a conflicting job in terms of both advertising alcohol and ensuring that it's consumed safely.
Steve, you wanted to say something. And what about that contradiction?
I don't think the prohibition analogy really works very well because, again, we don't have anything like prohibition. We have wine and spirits readily available through the state stores,
but they're not as easy.
The finding that people drink more and that you have social impacts when states and actually Canadian provinces privatize, that comes from actual episodes of states changing their policies, and the best research looking at kind of before and after. In many cases, you're able to control for the next state that didn't privatize, or within one state you privatized wine, but you didn't privatize the liquor. And so because of those natural experiments, scientists have been able to document that consumption of alcohol goes up after privatization and social problems go up. So this is not, you know, and the same thing on the revenue side. It's that, I mean, Roland Zulo, who's a research scientist at the University of Michigan, has done the best research on this area. So these aren't, you know, these things are, the claims I'm making are sort of well-established, but maybe a more important point, which goes back to the point, in a sense, about popularity. Yes, wine and spirits tends to be something that people, by and large, support, albeit it's a closer call than it was 3 or 4 years ago. But one thing that's very clear is this is not a priority for people. This and pensions are not a priority for people. What are a priority for Pennsylvanians are education funding and let's enact a common sense severance tax. And so this Republican budget, unfortunately, reflects the priorities of the Republican majority, not the people they represent. One particularly telling way that shows through is this budget doesn't restore funding for almost anything except the legislative line item. They put in $51 million more for the legislative line item when they put in $36 million more for higher education. They also, when it comes to economic development programs, job creation programs, which have been eviscerated since the end of Governor Rendell's term, but continuing under Governor Corbett, they did not increase a single line item for existing programs except one, the Commonwealth Financing Authority, which lo and behold is the one economic development program over which lawmakers have a veto. They get to decide what projects are funded and what projects are not funded.
Well, and, so and there I think we would agree, Steve, ways, that we're not any fans of that program
the
either.
The majority's priorities, not people's priorities. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just saying, I think we're in agreement on the Commonwealth Financing Authority. You know, we're also very concerned about the corporate giveaways that are included in this budget.
412-246-2002 is the number to call to join our conversation with Steve Herzenberg of the Steve Herzenberg of the Keystone Research Center and Liz Stell of the Commonwealth Foundation. Let's go to Steve from Evans City, who is on the line with a question. Steve, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to speak with you. My question is, you know, or I'll state it more upfront that we're getting a lot of this pandering of, you know, tax relief and all that nine yards. Many years ago, we passed a law for casinos, and there was supposed to be property tax relief from that. And as near as I can tell, there's been no relief at all. So where is any and all of this relief supposed to come from when we have a budget deficit and all those nine yards? And I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Good question. Good concern. Liz, you're nodding your head. I'll let you tackle that first.
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't blame the caller and all Pennsylvanians for being skeptical anytime there's a promise of property tax relief floated, given recent history. When you look at the competing proposals, there was a Republican proposal for property tax relief. There's the proposal under the governor's budget. The governor's budget is less of a return. Only 30 cents on the dollar do people get back in property tax relief for the tax increases. The Republican plan is more of a dollar-for-dollar match. But the real problem here is property taxes are a symptom, and they're a symptom of the pension problem. And so Steve mentioned, you know, people are really concerned about education spending, not pensions. Well, pensions is the underlying problem that's causing a lot of the tough choices that our districts or school districts have to make. So if you really want to tackle education, if you really want to tackle property tax relief, you have to tackle the pension system. And until you get substantial pension reform, something like the governor says he's going to veto, you're going to continue to have these schemes and this tax shifting that really doesn't do anything to solve the problem.
Yeah, and I would point to something else in terms of this driving local property taxes, that is the deep cuts to education funding, the roughly $1 billion in education funding that was cut in 2011-12, only half of which has been restored since then. I mean, there is actually some property tax relief from gaming money. It's about $600 million total, but a lot of places people don't see it because other forces like the state funding cuts. And the other critical factor is that Pennsylvania's overall funding of education, the state is near the bottom in terms of how much of the total funding for schools comes from the state. Too much of it is on local areas and where people don't have a lot of income and wealth, they end up suffering with high property taxes. So property taxes are actually an area where Governor Wolf, from the very beginning, reached out across the aisle, incorporated a bunch of revenue-raising proposals from previous Republican property tax bills, actually has substantial property tax relief in his proposal. He applauded the fact that the House Republicans passed a different property tax reduction bill, and one that I think is actually not as good for many Republican districts as Governor Wolf's proposal. Basically, the Republican property tax proposal gives a lot more money back to rich districts outside Philadelphia, like Lower Merion and Radnor. And so it wastes property tax relief on places where people aren't really demanding it and don't really need it. And because of that, you don't have as much for places like struggling places in and near Pittsburgh or, you know, the Poconos or Southern York, you know, certain pockets where property taxes are very high. But again, property taxes is an area where is ripe for bipartisan collaboration and to really address something that's important to many Pennsylvanians, not all. And so I hope that this somewhat flawed budget process doesn't lose us the chance for a once-in-a-generation property tax compromise that both parties can claim credit for.
We have a tweet from Nettie P, who says, I would really like to have my own wine shop and wine bar. Right now, my business idea is not possible in Pennsylvania. I hope it changes. And we also had an email, and I'll identify the emailer here in a moment, but he draws our attention to a Washington Post report about Washington residents voting to end. This would be Washington State. 2 years ago, Washington residents voted to end the state's monopoly on liquor sales in one of the most expensive campaigns ever waged. Retailers pumped tens of millions of dollars into convincing voters that private sales would benefit them more than leaving sales in the hands of the state. Now, however, Washington residents pay more for a liter of alcohol than residents in any other state. And though the initiative promised to fill the tax hole left by the absence of a monopoly, Washingtonians are spending less on liquor than the state had projected. So Times reporting over the weekend, cost of a liter of liquor after tax stands at $24.39, up from $21.19. That's $21.19 before privatization took effect.
Well, and in Washington, they actually added a bunch of taxes to the proposal to privatize. So it's important to keep in context here that it's not a direct apples-to-apples comparison before and after privatization when you're talking taxes on the actual product.
But that could happen here, conceivably.
It's possible, but it's not in the current liquor privatization bill that the governor has vetoed.
That came from Gene, by the way. I need to move this along because we're running out of time, sure. And I wanted to get your takes on the Obama administration saying it will soon propose a rule that could raise to as high as $50,400 the annual earnings threshold of salaried employees eligible for overtime pay when they exceed 40 hours of work each week. The current threshold is $23,660. Liz Stell, what do you think of what the president is proposing?
So this looks like it's designed to help workers to, you know, increase incomes, but unfortunately,
well, be paid for the work that they're doing, right?
Right.
That they're currently not being paid for.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. What it really amounts to is additional regulation on employers that's going to make things less flexible. So, for instance, I work from home. Individuals who work from home are going to have a lot fewer options underneath this because employers are going to be much more concerned about exactly how many hours they're putting in. They might be asked to work in the office more. There's going to be more restrictions. So in the end, it really means less flexibility for workers. And what employers will probably do is just shift compensation around so that your lower income workers will have even less than what they had before. So you're really not creating an additional wealth here. You're just putting more burdens on the system. And that really is not going to generate any additional prosperity for workers.
And Steve, what your take?
Sure. I mean, we think this is an issue of basic fairness. American workers are tired of being nickel and dimed by being asked to perform undocumented and unpaid overtime. You know, Americans believe in a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, and this change helps restore that value. updating the overtime regulations will also create more economy-boosting jobs that pay enough to support a family and increase demand at local businesses. Updating the overtime regulations will also help relieve the stress on hardworking families and better balance work and family responsibilities. I think stepping back from the details, I think the flaw here is the issue is not regulation or no regulation. You can't have an economy without regulation anymore, including rules, for example, about property ownership, any more than you can have a sport without a set of rules. And so what you need is a set of regulations that make your economy ultimately more productive and also more humane, more supportive of strong families and communities. The fact that this overtime rule has been frozen at around $20,000 for several decades now is just part of having, you know, an unfair economy, an economy where all of the gains go to the top, an economy with bad rules. So this updates the rules in a good way, promotes more good competition. Good employers know that being fair to your employees pays back the business many times over. Good employers don't cheat employees by not paying them overtime, by nickel and diming them. So we think this is a really positive change.
All right, very quickly before we wrap this up, because we're down to less than a minute, the governor is in favor of what the president is proposing. I'm not sure about if they're in agreement on the exact amount, but both the president and Governor Wolf want to raise the minimum wage. In 10 seconds, Liz, good idea, bad idea? Does the Commonwealth Foundation support that?
You know, we think minimum wage is a policy with good intentions but bad consequences. You're going to kill jobs. You're going to make it more difficult for people to prosper. And all in all, there are much better alternatives like reducing regulations, scaling back licensing, lots of other things you can do to help people get better employment in the state.
Steve Hertzenberg, quick final word on that, on the minimum wage.
Yeah, I'm raising the minimum wage to $10.10 per hour. It would benefit 1.2 million Pennsylvanians. It would create more economy-boosting jobs, putting into money into the pocket of hardworking families, and it would eliminate many economy-busting jobs that are part of why we have such a slow recovery right now, because people aren't being paid much. So absolutely, let's increase the minimum wage.
We've been talking with Steve Hertzenberg, who is the executive director of the Keystone Research Center, joining us by phone. And also here in studio with us, Liz Stell, who is the foundation director of the policy director for the Commonwealth Foundation. Liz Stell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, travel correspondent Elaine LaBom on why a road trip to Ohio is a good idea. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Across the nation, there is no shortage of museums, whether they're devoted to art, musical instruments, or sports. These cultural institutions have a lot to offer. While there are great museums here in the Allegheny region, contributor Elaine LaBom, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town and is a work of art herself, this week takes us on a road trip to Ohio for a little culture. Elaine LaBom, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. And you always put a smile on my face by saying something so nice. Thank you, Paul.
It comes from the heart. Okay, new girl, you're sending us on a trek to our neighbor to the west. Good thing it's not in the midst of Steelers-Browns season, because the rivalry there, some pretty strong feelings on both sides, right?
Indeed. And somehow we managed to get through it. But, you know, Ohio is our direct neighbor to the west. It's easy day trip territory, great for an overnight as well. And so many folks from this region, from Western PA, have school ties to Ohio, have family in Ohio. And in addition to just wanting to go there and tour around, I have to say, having just come back from some time with family, you go visit family, you need other things to do to break up that family time too. So it's good to know what your options are in various points in Ohio to keep everybody happy.
You've charted something of an unexplored path for us, and it starts in Youngstown, Ohio, which is just over the Pennsylvania border.
Absolutely, very close by. And there is an absolute gem here, the Butler Institute of American Art. This was actually the first museum solely devoted to American art in the U.S. It opened in 1919. Stunning, low-slung building on the National Register by the architects McKim Mead White, very renowned firm. And they just do wonderful work at this small museum, which is free, by the way. The current exhibit is the annual exhibition of the Associated Artists of Pittsburgh. They've put on a terrific show. And another neat thing they've got going on just right now is an exhibit of Bob Dylan's portraits. And he's been dabbling in pastels and, you know, a variety of medium in addition to music.
Who knew?
And that's really, it's a very interesting show. But it's easy to get to Youngstown. What, an hour away, if that, you know, extended an extra hour, spend the night in Columbus where you've got, you know, lots of cool things going on in the Short North neighborhood. So it's a great little day trip or even an overnight.
Next up is Kent, Ohio, and some unexpected gems there.
Again, another very much under the radar museum, the Kent State University Museum. And they have a very discreet emphasis on fashion and the decorative arts. They've got 9 galleries. They've got a very good costume collection, glass, textiles, furniture. They actually have an exhibit right now of the American designer Jeffrey Bean, who was very, very popular, much loved in through the latter half of the 20th century. Another thing that you wouldn't want to miss in Kent, Ohio, is the May 4 Visitor Center that, you know, memorializes the Kent State Massacre, as it was known, May 4, 1970. Four students gunned down by the Ohio National Guard, many others injured. And they've done something very neat, very 21st century, and that is that you can check out an iPad with a documentary basically speaking to a number of markers that are in the area, something of a self-guided walking tour, and then you accompany it with this documentary on an iPad to give you more information about what happened that day. This really is a teachable moment for so many of us, something we don't want to see recreated. So those are two things that you would not want to miss in Kent, Ohio.
Akron is back on the map as the home of LeBron James, but it plays host to other world-class talents.
Yeah, two things I absolutely love here, other than the fact that LeBron's from there, the Akron Art Museum. This is a world-class museum. It's modern and contemporary art, the tremendous permanent collection. Another thing you wouldn't want to miss, it's the Stan Hewitt Hall and Gardens. And if there is something in America close to Downton Abbey, it is this, right there in Akron, Ohio. Now, granted, back in the day, there was a lot of money in Ohio and in Akron as well. This is the 6th largest historic home in the U.S., absolutely stunning, and their collections and furnishings are all original. That is something that you will rarely find in a historic home in the U.S. So if you want to get that little fix of Downton Abbey, a lot of us are missing it, waiting for that January premiere again, I would say check that out.
And Cleveland has a lot more to offer than the Cavaliers and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, correct?
You know, and I would certainly not diss either of those. I visit them every time I go to Cleveland. But you also want to get to University Circle if you can. The Cleveland Museum of Art, another top 5 museum in the U.S., world-class and free. Cleveland Museum of Natural History is also in University Circle. Severance Hall, phenomenal historic structure where the Cleveland Orchestra plays. Top 5 orchestra in the U.S. have some friends who play for them. Cleveland Botanical Garden. You can really, make a weekend out of it and absolutely not miss Melt, one of my favorite restaurants in Cleveland.
You always bringing up the food right around lunchtime.
Yes.
Elaine LaBaume, our travel contributor, joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh. As always, Elaine, great thanks.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, he's sold millions and millions of records. Legendary recording artist Johnny Mathis joins us on the program. He's coming to Pittsburgh next week to perform with the Pittsburgh Symphony, and he'll tell us all about it. And also, don't forget that on Wednesday, July 15th, WESA is holding a community forum on the impact of the Americans with Disabilities Act on the city. It'll be broadcast live on 90.5 starting at 7 p.m. The doors open at 6:30. Space is limited, so please register now. Go to our website, wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.